This isn't targeting anybody. This is really reaffirming parental rights.
Governor Dunleavy floats education bills aimed at increasing parental permission for sex ed. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 7th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, Iditarod mushers describe challenging conditions on the way into the Nikolai checkpoint.
This is as bad as I've ever seen it as far as the moguls go. And then there's actually mud on several miles of it too, which I've never seen mud before.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Governor Mike Dunleavy announced a bill today that would increase the amount of parental permission needed to teach sex education and would require school districts separate student locker room and bathroom facilities by biological sex rather than gender identity. If passed by the legislature, students would need their parents' permission before taking a sex education class or joining a club related to gender or sexuality.
There should never be a case where a parent sends their kids to school and the child comes back having discussions about things they learned in school that may be a sensitive issue or an affront to a parent's values.
The bill would require school districts to divide locker rooms and restrooms by gender assigned at birth. Parents would also need to give written permission for students to change their names or pronouns at school. Anchorage Democratic Senator Lukey Tobin chairs the Senate Education Committee. She says the bill could increase feelings of isolation among LGBTQ students.
They are probably our most vulnerable young people. And in many cases, their public school is the safest place for them. It's where the trusted adult that sees them for who they are. It's where they can go by their correct name and their correct pronouns, and where they get to be a kid.
Dunleavy denied that the bill targets queer and trans youth. Instead, he said it's meant to strengthen parental rights and increase transparency in schools.
This isn't targeting anybody. This is really reaffirming parental rights and that the parents of these children have a right to know what their children are doing in school, what topics are being taught.
Dunleavy also introduced a bill to increase teacher recruitment and retainment by giving full-time teachers an annual payment for the next 3 years. Payments could be $5,000, $10,000, or $15,000, depending on the district, with the highest payments going to teachers in the most remote areas. Meanwhile, crews in Prince of Wales Island's largest community are working to restore service after a water outage that began Sunday. City officials in Craig issued a boil water notice on Sunday after water pressure plummeted, leaving some residents with dirty water and others with none. City officials say crews were working today to get the system's pressure up high enough to take bacterial samples. Clear samples could allow the city to lift the notice by March 12th, but as KRBD's Reagan Miller reports, they won't end the problem at Craig's drinking water treatment plant.
By Tuesday morning, Craig Public Works crews had one of four so-called treatment trains running normally and were working to bring another back online after Sunday's outage. City Administrator Brian Templin says crews are working to clear clogged filters.
The second train that we replaced the media in, they ran the first backwash last night and are expecting to run the second backwash this morning. And once the second backwash has been run, and then they can start producing water and putting it into the system from that train.
He says that with two trains working, that'll allow the system's pressure to rise. After that, crews can start collecting water samples to test it for bacteria like E. coli. Templin says that could begin as soon as Wednesday. They'll send those to the State Department of Environmental Conservation.
Right now, we expect that when the second treatment train gets fully online today, that we will get water in the system and get the system up to the pressure by late this afternoon or this evening. And that'll put us in a position to take our water samples tomorrow and send them off to the lab.
Those samples need to come back clean before the boil water notice can end. Craig City officials announced the notice Sunday evening, warning residents to boil their water for at least 2 minutes before using it for drinking, cooking, or teeth brushing. Templin says the notice was put in place because when water pressure levels drop too far, it allows contaminants in the system. The outage has shuttered tribal offices, schools, the public library, the youth center, and the pharmacy. The DEC requires boil water notices when water pressure drops below 20 pounds per square inch. In a Monday announcement, city officials said results were not expected before the weekend. That means residents will see water return to their pipes, but they are still expected to have to boil it through at least Sunday. But it could be a while before all four treatment trains are running normally. Two are only partially working, and Templin says they'll need to order new filters to return to full capacity.
We're working through a project to order and replace the filter media in those two other treatment trains.
Templin says it's unclear when those parts might arrive. Templin says that the plant had been nursing a problem with clogged filters for a few weeks. He says crews had been gearing up to fix the problem when pressure fell. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Alaskans don't owe taxes on the full amount of their PFD checks from last year. A February 10th advisory from the IRS announced that the $662 energy relief portion of the payout won't be taxed. Alaskans need to pay taxes on the $2,622 dividend itself, which is subject to federal income tax, as it is every year. Allegra Hamer is the state coordinator of the AARP Foundation's Free Tax Aid program, and she says this exception can add up to a substantial amount of savings for Alaska families.
For a family of two adults and two children, for example, if you figure they're at a 10% or 12% tax bracket, it's $250 to about $300 more in their pocket instead of in IRS's pocket.
If you have not filed your taxes yet and are using an online software, Hamer says to simply enter the $2,622 amount for the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend when you reach the other income section. The energy relief portion does not need to be included anywhere on your tax forms. If you already filed and claim the full $3,284 amount, Hamer recommends filing an amendment to recoup the excess amount. She says her organization has been reaching out to clients who filed before the IRS announcement to help them make the change and hopes paid tax preparers are doing the same. Hamer says you can submit an amendment through tax software packages as well once it's out of draft form. But if you bank on the IRS correcting the error, Hamer says not to expect to hear from them anytime soon.
I don't know how IRS will handle that. So they may not hear from IRS at all, or if they do, it may be a year or a year and a half down the road.
The deadline to file your 2022 individual tax return is April 18th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, hundreds of elementary students on the Kenai Peninsula are learning about salmon cycles.
If they catch fish, that's awesome, and that just adds the excitement to do this again. But, you know, like, look at these guys over. They're just making a snow fort.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Grant applications are now being accepted for tribal justice grants through the U.S. Department of Justice. Coordinated Tribal Assistance Solicitation, or CETAS grants, fund tribal courts and tribal law enforcement, open to federally recognized tribes across Alaska. Applications are open until March 21st. Learn more at atjrc.org/CTAS. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tribal Justice Resource Center.
Mushers Ryan Reddington and Jesse Holmes are competing neck and neck for the lead in the Iditarod, followed closely by Richie Deal and last year's winner Brent Sass. Teams tackled a notoriously tough section of trail headed into the Nikolai checkpoint today. But just how tough was it? Well, as Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan reports, it depends on who you ask.
Pre-race reports about the notoriously challenging stretch of trail from Rome to Nikolai were bad. Iditarod officials described the section as the worst moguls in race history. After finishing the run, Kelly Maxner says his back is aching from the 75-mile run.
It is as bad as I've ever seen it as far as the moguls go. And then there was actually mud on several miles of it too, which I've never seen mud before.
He decides to take a five-hour break in Nikolai, a community checkpoint about a quarter through the 1,000-mile race. Maxner says the trail was also hard on his dogs, which likely means he'll take his mandatory day-long rest earlier than he expected.
It'll be good. They're a little maybe banged up, so we're probably going to 24 earlier than I think I was going to, but they're fine. They're all energetic and going and happy to go. I just want to make sure they're healed up for the rest of the race. So.
But most teams, especially those that raced last year, say the trail was actually better than they expected. Richie Diehl is running his 11th Iditarod. He says he actually had a good time.
Probably the best I've ever seen it from Roan over here to Nicolai. It was a really, really nice trail. There was a little mogul-y in places, but not nearly as bad as last year.
For mushers who decided to stop in Nicolai, the checkpoint was a good spot to stop to recover from their aches and work on their sleds. Ryan Reddington is switching out a strip of sled runner plastic when he discovers some damage.
Sorry, I just see a crack in my runner here. I'll be changing sleds now and McGrath. Yeah, hopefully that makes it to McGrath.
Riley Dyke had an adaptation on his sled to deal with the constant yanking going over the moguls. He had a loop of bungee cord attached to the gang line in front of his sled to absorb some of the tension.
It's kind of nice early. It takes a little power off the dogs, which is actually kind of nice, but I'm ready to not have it on there anymore.
Several top mushers sent dogs home in Nicolai that had sustained minor injuries on the trail. Reigning champ Brent Sass has a dog, Marty, sitting in his sled bag when he pulls in.
I'd have been carrying a lot of dogs. I carried this guy for 60 miles, so that was fun. But yeah, you know, nothing goes to plan ever. Luckily, I'm used to that in my life. There's nothing that goes to plan in my life, so.
Sass is the first out of the checkpoint pulled by an 11-dog team. That's the same number of dogs he finished with last year, and he still has more than 700 miles to get to Nome. Musher Jesse Holmes also has an injury. He says he rested out on trail during the tough run. He still has a tender wrist from a construction accident last spring, but it wasn't his wrist that bothered him as he cut open the bags filled with extra gear. Instead, it was his bashed knee.
My wrist is doing good, actually. I bashed up my knee last night, though. And I couldn't really walk this morning, but I took a nap and I'm all good now, so.
He pulls his snow hook and after just a 14-minute stop, is on his way.
You know the outbound trail?
Yep.
Okay. See if the dogs do that.
Yeah. All right.
Reporting in Nicolai, I'm Lex Trinan.
An Anchorage Assembly member wants to ban the use of facial recognition technology by the city government. East Anchorage Assembly member Joey Sweet is drafting the proposal. He said during a public safety committee meeting last week that while the city doesn't use the technology yet and Anchorage police say it's not a priority to get it, he wants to be proactive.
Policy is so often reactive. I don't want there to be an incident and then we respond to it, right? I want to do this now.
Essentially, facial recognition technology maps out someone's face and compares it to database images like mugshots and driver's license photos. There's currently no federal regulation of the use of the technology, and Sweet says that's led to private vendors reaching out to governmental bodies to sell the technology. But he says federal research has found that the technology isn't perfect.
Oftentimes, facial recognition algorithms and the databases they use end up having inaccuracies, and those inaccuracies disproportionately impact people of color.
Sweet cited the example of Robert Williams, a black man in Detroit who was arrested by police after facial recognition technology misidentified him as a robbery suspect.
There was traditional surveillance that showed a man robbing a jewelry store about 18 months prior to the arrest, and any human being can plainly tell they aren't the same person, but a facial recognition database believed that they were the same, and the police arrested him off of that information.
Williams later sued the city of Detroit, something Sweet says he'd like to avoid in Anchorage. He says he's also concerned over how the use of the technology could overlap with Alaska's strict privacy laws. Sweet says a draft of the ordinance he's proposing is being finalized and soon will be ready for introduction to the full assembly. An Alaska group is coordinating an international meeting at the end of this month to discuss policies for the far north. Arctic Encounter will host 13 countries for 3 days at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. KUAC's Robin reports.
Making sure Alaska is represented at the table of Arctic nations is one of the goals of Arctic Encounter.
Is to get Fairbanks and Anchorage recognized as international hubs of Arctic policy to the level of Oslo and Tromsø and Reykjavik.
Brittany Smart works in the mayor's office at the Fairbanks North Star Borough. She gave a presentation on the conference to the Greater Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce last week on Arctic Encounter and its three-day symposium in Anchorage at the end of March. Sadie Blancaflor, program director with Arctic Encounter, says the giant conference is their flagship event.
This is the United States' largest North American gathering that's focused on the Arctic. Alaska is the United States' claim to the Arctic, and Arctic Encounter is what brings folks from around the world to Alaska to see what Alaska has to offer to the global stage as it relates to discussions and policy and business in the global north.
Blancaflor says Arctic Encounter just hosted an event in October with the government of Greenland in Iceland. Arctic Encounter is not a legislative body, but Smart says the borough is starting to pay a lot more attention to the international gatherings like the symposium, where reps from 13 Arctic nations are signed up, and other nations are starting to see Alaska as an important player. Smart pointed out the yet-to-be-confirmed U.S. ambassador to the Arctic, Mike Sfraga, is from Fairbanks. Borough Mayor Bryce Ward will be on a panel at the symposium. Smart says there are many international bodies focusing on the Arctic, and Alaska representatives need to be heard.
There's a lot of investment and a lot of big idea projects that are moving forward, and they are going to either happen to us or with us. And this is a huge opportunity to make sure that what does happen is mutually beneficial.
Blancaflor says in addition to plenary sessions and breakout sessions from nonprofit groups and businesses, they are also making it a cultural gathering.
So we're featuring Alaska Native art. We're having a Far North fashion show featuring different Alaska Native designers. And we are also featuring Byron Nicolai, who is an incredible Yupik musician.
Yes, there will be senators and ambassadors at the Dena'ina Center. But Blancaflor says you don't have to be a specialist to attend the symposium.
We welcome community members. We actually just launched a rural elders and youth scholarship program. We recognize that oftentimes the cost to attend conferences can be inaccessible, and we want to make sure that community voices are there and are able to take the information back into their communities. So if anyone is interested in applying for that scholarship, it's on our website as well.
That website is arcticencounter.com. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Matson, delivering the goods and materials Alaskans depend on Facebook at Matson in Alaska. Matson, supporting public media in Alaska.
Parents go to great lengths to protect their little ones. When it comes to protection from childhood diseases, go with the safest, most effective choice. Start strong by getting all recommended vaccines for your baby by age 2. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. That's vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
The Yukon River's Chum and King runs have returned at record lows the last 3 years. At a recent meeting, the Alaska Board of Fisheries debated a contentious proposal that would have reduced fishing time for a controversial and lucrative fishery along the Alaska Peninsula called Area M. The board ended up passing some restrictions on the fishery, but it's far short of what YK Delta residents were hoping for. And as KDLG's Izzy Ross reports, communities that depend on the Area M fishery aren't happy either.
People from across Western Alaska testified in support of limiting fishing time in Area M, saying they haven't been able to feed their families or continue traditions since the chum runs collapsed in 2020. Tanya Ivan is from Russian Mission. She told the board they weren't asking to close the fishery, but rather spread restrictions more equally across the regions.
Our subsistence needs have not been met. My smokehouse and freezer have not had fish in few years, which means I wasn't able to teach my baby sister and daughters our traditional way of life. What we rely on during the winter, and especially during the Russian Orthodox Great Lent.
The Alaska Board of Fisheries members were divided on reducing fishing time in Area M. Some pointed to the state's subsistence priority, while others cited the economic importance of the fishery. In the end, the board narrowly passed an amendment that restricts some fishing time in June and sets up tiered reductions for the purse seine fleet based on the chum harvest. But it was far short of the sweeping restrictions YK Delta residents were hoping for. After the vote, most of the people in the audience walked out of the room in protest. Robert Walker is the first tribal chief of Anvik, a community on the Yukon River.
It just canceled us, AYK tribal people, right out. It's like we were a foreign country. And we just kind of like got up and left.
Walker says the amendment ignored days of testimony from the region. But the Area M fishery is a vital part of the communities along the Alaska Peninsula and in the Aleutians. Alvin Osterbach, mayor of the Aleutians East Borough, says harvest limits could mean a huge revenue hit for some of the communities there.
By coming in and attacking us like this all the time, it's moving more and more of our families out of the area. And you can see it in the communities. They're just, people are leaving.
He says it's tough to say exactly how this season will play out with the new limits. Area M's South Peninsula was valued at over $33 million last year. In 2021, the average seiner made around $700,000. Harvest caps can drive down the value of the fishery, forcing fishermen to sell their permits. Kylie Thompson, president of the Area M Seiners, says major cuts to that lucrative June fishery, which makes up a quarter of Area M's entire value, could put the fleet in jeopardy. Still, he says the new restrictions are workable.
June is our steady, you know, high-value sockeye, kind of what everybody depends on. And without the June fishery, I mean, that's the straw that breaks the camel's back for that region. The June fishery is so important, because it's relatively stable.
Meanwhile, people from Western Alaska who asked for stronger restrictions in Area M are disillusioned with the state's system. Henry Hunter Sr. is the vice chairman of Arutzaharamut Native Council in Bethel. He's deeply disappointed in the board. He says it feels like the meeting was stacked against their region and that the board is prioritizing commercial interests over subsistence needs.
They basically commercial fishing. Commercial fishing in Area M is big business. They should be the ones that conserve and manage it for all Alaskans. Not only Area M fishing, commercial fishing, but the subsistence users in the YK Delta.
Hunter thinks the decision means the burden of conservation will continue to rest on people in Western Alaska when it should be the board's responsibility to manage for everyone. With help from KUCB's Maggie Nelson, in Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
Kenai Peninsula students got a chance to get out on the ice with fishing rods and bait last week. It's part of a program run by the Department of Fish and Game with local schools and homeschooling families to teach kids about fish, their varieties, and habitats throughout the year. KBBI's Corin Smith tagged along with elementary students at the Homer Reservoir and has this report.
About 50 feet out on the ice of Homer's frozen reservoir, dozens of students from kindergarten to second grade are bundled up and gathered in twos and threes around cut holes in the ice. They each hold a mini fishing rod baited with shrimp. 6-year-old Solo Sky Frost sits patiently jigging the line as instructed, waiting for a fish. It's his first time fishing, and he's focused.
I'm trying to ice fish, which I've never done before. Okay, this is my first day, actually.
The ice fishing event is part of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's annual Salmon in the Classroom program, which teaches Kenai Peninsula students about salmon biology throughout the school year, says Fish and Game sport fish biologist Holly Dixon.
So most of these kids back in their classrooms have aquariums where they're raising salmon eggs to fry, and then they'll release them in the spring. And this is just one of the other events that happens throughout the winter as part of that program.
Today, students are fishing for Dolly Varden, which can be found in freshwater lakes like the reservoir or the open ocean, which can grow up to 30 inches or 27 pounds.
It's the middle of the winter, so they are not as actively feeding, but when the kids drop bait down on a jig, it might be the first snack they've seen in a while. A lot of the dollies are pretty long and skinny, and so I think they can be voracious at times up here. especially when we show up with a bunch of kids and a bunch of bait.
Dixon says the outdoor event helps students learn about ice fishing gear, technique, and safety, as well as sport fish harvest limits and deciding whether to catch or release a fish. After about an hour, there are not a lot of bites, and some students leave their rods secured in the snow to run and check on each other to see who's caught a fish. There's also snacks and hot cocoa to help with the waiting. Aaron Pollock is a kindergarten teacher with Fireweed Academy, a Homer-based charter school, one of the classrooms where students are experiencing the life cycle of salmon firsthand.
In the fall, we go to the Anchor River for a field trip where we actually cut open salmon and we fertilize the eggs with the milk, and then we get to bring the eggs back to our classroom and raise them in a tank. And so we have eggs at our classroom that have hatched into fry, and the kids are starting to be able to feed them, and they record the temperature in the tank every day, and they're so excited they've each named one of the fish.
Pollock says while some students are fishing for the first time, others come from commercial fishing families and are very familiar. Regardless, the learning experience also connects students to the community.
Maybe a third of our families are fishing families, whether they're gillnetters or seiners or whatever part it may be in our community. And then we have maybe at least half who have no idea that this existed as an option. And even the fishing families didn't know that you can ice fish here in the winter. I didn't know that, and I've been salmon seining for like 7 years. So last year was my first year coming to this program, and I was like, what do you mean there's fish in the reservoir? I love ice fishing. I had no idea.
Ryan Lee is a parent volunteer and says his second grader has been out ocean and river fishing quite a bit. But he says it's about having fun outside.
That's learning, you know, being in nature, keeping themselves busy, like, you know, just doing active stuff outside. If they catch fish, that's awesome, and that just adds to the excitement to do this again. But, you know, like, look at these guys over. They're just making a snow fort. You know, it doesn't matter if they're fishing or not, as long as they're warm and moving around and having fun.
The Department of Fish and Game says 675 Kenai Peninsula students participated in 2 days of ice fishing at Sport Lake in Soldotna and at the Homer Reservoir. There's the promise of taking the fish home and cooking it up with families, but today only one dolly was caught and released. Students will have to hope for more bites another day. In Homer, I'm Corinne Smith.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Katie Anastas in Juneau, Reagan Miller in Ketchikan, Michael Finelli in Anchorage, Lex Trinan in Nikolai, Robin in Fairbanks, Izzy Ross in Dillingham, and Corinne Smith in Homer. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.